I am assuming that you've read through the book of Ruth per my command. Okay, so I don't have to take attendance, I assume, that you've had the opportunity to read through this short little book. We're going to move through it at a pace that is what I will call compact and comfortable. It's a short book, and because it's so compact, it really won't take very long to go through it. But we'll move through it at a fairly brisk pace, nonetheless, because of its shortness. We'll call it a fair pace, okay? And this morning I decided I want to deal with just the opening, or what sets the story in motion. Only the first 14 verses of the book that sets the story in place, because I think this is appropriate along the way, and you'll see that as we're going along. Now, the main character of the book is not Ruth. I mean, no, I know that's how she's titled, and so she's the one that everybody looks to and says, it's a book about her. She's crucial. I mean, no doubt she is the one who has great faith in the God of Naomi. She is the one who seeks out Boaz. She is the one who is ultimately, at the end of the book, the great-grandmother of David. But really, this story revolves around Naomi. It's really a story of Naomi more than it is even of Ruth. Ruth is, if the Academy Awards were being given for this book, Naomi would be the lead actress and Ruth would be a supporting actress in the story. So the only reason it's called Ruth is because she is at the end of the story, the great-grandmother of David. Thus she gets that primary position. It's Naomi who's the initial focus of the book. It's Naomi who's the initial focus. She is the one who is widowed in Moab. She is the one who returns to Israel with Ruth clinging to her. She is the one who has relatives who help, who suggest Boaz as a mate for Ruth and a redeemer for herself. She's the one at the end of the story who's praised by the local women after the birth. And she is the one who even names, if you will, the child as a part of the process. So she's really the primary character of this book. And the book opens with her. It opens with her. Ruth is not even a part of the picture until you get about halfway through the first chapter. It's really about Naomi. But the book also, as I said last week, really begins very darkly. This book starts with a natural darkness to it. And I use the word oppression to describe this darkness. There is an oppression that comes upon Naomi, a great oppression. And it's oppression, an oppression that comes from sinful choices on the part of others that make the way this oppression comes. But it's not just an oppression based on sinful choices. It's also an oppression of personal choices on her part as well, which is what I want to demonstrate as we get through our time this morning. All of this, if I might remind you, is a part of the cycle of sin and oppression that we talked of last week. The story begins with sin and oppression, the darkness of the times, the period of the judges, which finds its way into the story itself here. As the last sentence of the book of Judges says, there was no king in Israel in those days. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That becomes a darkness. In fact, we could make a strong argument that judgment is God giving you what you want. And so this period of time is a period of judgment. Pardon the pun. See it? It's a period in which men were doing what they wanted because there was no king in Israel and thus they were being judged. This cycle then of sin and oppression begins with this kind of judgment that marks the times, but also the outline of the story itself. So this oppression marks the opening of the book, but it is also what makes the story glorious in the end. We must start with this sense of oppression and darkness at the beginning, because it's only against the backdrop of this darkness that the end of the story becomes as glorious as it is. It is in many ways an encapsulation of the entirety of the redemptive story of God himself, where in the beginning it begins with darkness, but it ends with great glory. It's true for us in the gospel. Even though our lives begin with great sin and rejection of this God, it ends with great glory in the gospel. The message of the gospel, the good news of the gospel, is only understood against the backdrop of darkness and evil. So this is what you have starting this book. You have a sense in which the writer starts off with this great darkness and oppression. The redemption of Naomi and the birth of Obed are the climax of God bringing forth good out of evil according to his purposes and plans. And so what we see taking place here in this story is God bringing good out of oppression. I would have you note, just as a tangent, and didn't really notice this until late in the week, that the very chapter that Perry just read to you is the very chapter which describes the men leading to this book. The children that were born, Perez and his brother, are the twins mentioned at the end of this book. And you will notice that it also starts with great oppression and sin and ends gloriously in the end. So, let us enter into the story then, shall we? As the book opens, we are introduced to a man by the name of Elimelech. And this man, Elimelech, has two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Elimelech is from the tribe of Ephraim. He's called an Ephrathite in the book. That's from the tribe of Ephraim. Ephraim, if you know your geography of the tribes of Israel, probably don't. Ephraim was actually located very much in the center of Israel, Canaan. Ephraim was allotted territory in central Canaan in the hill country. It was surrounded by Dan to the west towards the sea, half tribe of Manasseh to the north, and also around towards the Jordan River, Benjamin and Judah on its south. So it was a landlocked territory granted to the Ephrathites in the middle part of the country. The early part of the book of Judges notes that the Israelites were confined to the hill country in the days of the Judges. So they're confined to this hilly land that runs as a spine north and south through Canaan, through the central part of Canaan. They are limited to that space. It won't be until the time of David when they're able to fan out into the valley towards the sea and across to the Jordan, in which they'll be able to extend themselves out more. This man is living near a town known as Bethlehem in Judah. Yes, this is the same Bethlehem that is the home of David and the birthplace of Jesus. It is located just south of the border between Judah and Benjamin, about 10 miles south of the city of Jerusalem. At this time, the city of Jerusalem is owned by the Jebusites, so it's not known as Jerusalem at this time. It's known as Jebus. This is a well-known village that existed in the days of the Judges. There are a couple of different mentions of Bethlehem in the book of Judges, although there's one having to do with one of the judges of Israel from Bethlehem, but that's a different Bethlehem. But there are a couple of references to this particular Bethlehem. In Genesis 35, we are told that this particular village is the burial place of Rachel, the wife of Jacob, was buried there. In Genesis 17, we are told about Micah the thieving apostate, who established a personal shrine in the city of Bethlehem. And then in the following chapters, 19 through 21, a Levite and his concubine tarry there in Benjamin for a day or several days. Her death in Gibeah to the south eventually leads to the Benjamite War, which occupies the last couple of chapters of the book of Judges. And so this is a very important little village, if you will, even from three generations prior to David himself. Elimelech and his family, it says in this text, are living in Judah, although they belong to the tribe of Ephraim. So they're living in Judah, in Bethlehem, but they belong to the tribe of Ephraim. Now, that's not unusual, and for a couple of different reasons. One reason I'll give you that's not in my notes is that if you look at a map of the way that the various tribes are laid out in Israel in the days of the judges, those lines that are drawn are gray, to say the least. They're not fixed. They're just kind of where those tribes landed. Now, I know that in the days of Joshua, there were specific points and of where the various places were, and so we can draw those lines. But people migrated and moved based on a whole raft of reasons. I mean, even in this book, we're told that there's a famine which causes this man to leave. And so there's a whole lot of reasons why people moved around. So there isn't a sense in which you can just look at those various places on the map and say, okay, here's where the Ephrathites lived, and here's where the people of Judah lived, and here's where Reuben and half of Manasseh and another half of Manasseh and so forth. It's not that simple. It's not that simple. Yes, it is true that there were people that were established on the other side of the Jordan, half tribe of Manasseh and Reuben, etc., but at the same time, there were not a whole lot of people living over there. It's not a very hospitable place, frankly. So the fact is these things have a tendency to migrate. So it's very possible that at some time in Elimelech's past, one of his relatives married someone from the tribe of Judah, which allotted him land then down near Bethlehem instead of in the area of Ephraim. That would be completely normal and not unusual at all. Okay. Think about this, for example. The tribe of Simeon, if you remember, when the tribes are allotted, was entirely within the boundaries of Judah, to the south, down in the Negev. And yet, by the time of Solomon, there's no mention of Simeon again. It's gone. Why? Well, because more than likely, all the people of Simeon simply integrated with the people of Judah, and they became one tribe over time. So, it's not unusual that a man who is an Ephrathite is actually living in Judah. Now, it says, as I mentioned a moment ago, that there's a famine in this land. In fact, right at the very beginning, when the judges ruled the land, there was a famine there. The writer indicates that this famine is what causes Elimelech to move his family to Moab. Now, again, bore you with a bit more geography, all right? Moab is a territory and a people located on the other side of the Dead Sea. You remember, if your geography of Canaan, ancient Canaan, you have the hill country going down the center of Canaan, and then you see a small sea, a river running south to the Dead Sea. On the other side of the Dead Sea, then, in what we would call the Transjordan, draw a line about the middle part of the Dead Sea straight east, and draw another line at the bottom of the Dead Sea, or just bottom of the Dead Sea straight east. That's the territory of Moab. So on the other side of the Dead Sea, in the lower half of that area down below, it would have been for Elimelech only about a 50-mile journey from Bethlehem to the lowest end of Moab on the other side of the Dead Sea, assuming that he would travel south and east on the western side of the Dead Sea and go around and underneath and come up from below. Moab, however, is not just a territory, as I said, it's also a people. Moab is a people. Moab was one of the original and most significant enemies of Israel. Moab was born out of an incestuous relationship years before. And these people that were descended were opposed to Israel as it entered Canaan. You go to Numbers 22 through 25, you have the whole Balaam incident. You remember where Balaam comes and produces curses against Israel because he's hired by the Moabites to go and bring curses against Israel. And his donkey speaks to him in the midst of this process. Okay, all of that is related to the people living there in that place. They were one of the first opposers of Israel when the people came from Egypt after their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness to come in and to take the land. And I think God purposely brought them around the bottom of the Dead Sea and north and into Canaan across the Jordan because he wanted the Israelites to come up against the Moabites there in that place. He purposed them to come to that territory. They refused to allow them to cross. They were afraid. The Moabites, I should say, were afraid of the Israelites coming into that territory. I don't know why. I mean, why would you be afraid when 2.5 million people show up at your southern border? I mean, there'd be no reason to be afraid of that whatsoever. especially the fact that they've got lots of flocks and herds going with them. But they were afraid, and they prohibited them from coming. And so God cursed them. According to Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 6, they were prohibited from the assembly of the Lord to the 10th generation. 10 generations later, from the time that these Moabites refused to let the Israelites in, for 10 generations, they're prohibited, any one of them, from entering into the assembly of the Lord. That's a serious curse that God puts upon them. They are also mentioned in Ezra 9 as one of the nations that ultimately produced the exile that Ezra and Nehemiah brought the people back. Zerubbabel and Ezra brought the people back from. They're mentioned as one of the specific peoples that had produced the exile itself. Thus, Elimelech moves his family to a land and a people that are dangerous to them. We read this story and we just sort of pass over it because we don't really think about the Moabites anymore. They're long since gone into the dustbin of history and we don't really care anymore. But what this man did around 1100 BC was move his family directly into a land occupied by a people who just a few generations before had opposed the Israelites themselves. He moves his family into enemy territory. He moves them into a place that are dangerous to him. Now, at first glance, it would appear that the original trip was designed to be temporary. I have you notice in verse 1, it says in the ESV that he moved them there to sojourn in the country of Moab. That term, sojourn, is a term which is typically understood to be temporary. I go to sojourn in a place for a period of time in anticipation of leaving. To be a sojourn is to be a resident alien for a small period of time, particularly for a respite from something that you're running from, that you're being chased out from, okay? Joseph, you remember in Genesis 47, tells the Pharaoh, we've come to sojourn in Egypt for a brief time because there's a famine back in the land. So his family, he invites his family to come and to sojourn there. There was no expectation on the part of Joseph that his family would stay there for 400 years. What happened, but it was a resident alien kind of thing. Israelite law that God had given on Sinai was specific about being kind to sojourners. Deuteronomy 24:17. When the sojourner, the foreigner, comes into your land, when he's running from something that has caused him to flee and he comes to your land, treat him with dignity, treat him with hospitality, help him. If he decides to stay, let him join the assembly by becoming one of you. But as long as he's a sojourner, a temporary inhabitant, treat him with respect. So it would appear, doesn't it, that as you first start the story, it appears as though Elimelech was going temporarily to that place. There's a famine, we're going to go there, but we're going to come back. But you will notice that as verse 2 unfolds, it changes. Sojourn goes to remained there at the end of verse 2. And then in verse 4, it changes to lived there. And you will notice in this text, it says for 10 years. For 10 years. So that's not a sojourning anymore. It may have been originally intended that way. It may have been originally that Elimelech intended, I'm going to move my family there for a brief time. But apparently, they decided to stay. Now, look at verse 6. We're not quite to verse 6 yet in the story, but I just have you notice something about verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return to the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited people and given them food. Now, that phrase seems to indicate that they returned when the famine ended. Here's the problem. A 10-year famine in Canaan would have been a disastrous event. And when I say disastrous, I mean literally, nearly destroying the entirety of the people of Israel. There's no record of any such thing in the book of Judges. So it's highly unlikely that phrase means that after 10 years they discovered that the famine was over. No, More likely what it means is that the famine ended at some point prior to this time, but Elimelech and his family decided to stay. They got comfortable there. They stayed there. But Naomi now, in the midst of her situation, and you'll see the situation in a moment, in the midst of her situation, hears that there's food in Israel. And probably what that means is that she hears that the time of the harvest has come, and so she decides at the time of the harvest to go back. So it's not an indication that the famine lasted 10 years. It's more likely that the phrase simply indicates that Naomi decided to move her family back, or I should say move herself back, when food was most plentiful, at the harvest time. Now, read the rest of the story. What does Ruth do when she gets back? She goes to the fields and she begins to glean after the harvester. So there's clearly a time of harvest going on here, okay? So I think that the best way to interpret the first six verses of this book is this. Elimelech took his family and moved to Moab for respite from the famine, and he moved them even amongst their enemies, but stayed there even after the famine was over. He chose to stay in that place even after that. The 10 years seems likely to be interpreted that way. Now, once we get past verse 2, which tells us about who they are and where they were and what happened, it says in verse 3, then, that Elimelech dies. Now, there's no reason given for Elimelech's death in this book. And there's no reason to assume any sort of nefarious motives here. As with every man, Elimelech's natural fate is recounted. It is appointed unto every man once to die, so Elimelech does. There's no reason given, and there's no reason for us to be suspicious of his death. However, after his death, his two sons are now left as the patriarchs of the family, right? In an agrarian society, remember we're talking second millennium BC here, in an agrarian society, and that's such a situation when a parent dies, when a father dies, when the male dies, the eldest males then become the patriarch. The eldest male typically become the patriarch, but in this case they're not really spoken of, distinguished from one another, so they become the patriarchs of the family. And now, being men, now that they have been graduated, quote unquote, to the status of men because their father has died and they've now stepped up to the place of being the men, they seek the reasonable course of what men would do. They seek wives. They go find wives. I mean, that's reasonable. Okay, it's time to carry on the family line, and so we'll seek wives. But because they're living in Moab, they seek Moabite women. Chilion marries Orpah. Mahlon marries Ruth. How do I know that? Chapter 4, verse 10, Boaz mentions Ruth as the widow of Mahlon. For years, by the way, I overlooked that verse and thought he was married to Chilion. Had to go back and modify the Bible study I did many years ago for that error. Mahlon marries Ruth. Chilion marries Orpah. Now, there is no specific prohibition in the law against marrying Moabite women. There's no specific prohibition. In fact, if you look at Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 4, the Moabites are not listed amongst the nations that the people of Israel were not to intermarry with. There were a number of other nations mentioned, but the Moabites are not mentioned. However, the prohibition against marrying foreigners was for a reason, right? What was the reason given for God to say, you must not marry outside of Israel? And the answer is because the natural tendency will be, when you marry a foreigner, you're also marrying her religion. And you will, by extension, then embrace her paganism. Therefore, the specific prohibition of Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 4 isn't about which nations you shouldn't marry, but rather why you should not marry those other nations. And since Ezra 9 certainly seems to bear out that because of the fact that the Israelites had married Moabites and Edomites, that they were now in exile, or now come out of exile, it seems reasonable to assume that marrying Moabite women would not have been what God would have wanted. Just because God didn't list them amongst the people in Deuteronomy 7 doesn't mean that the principle doesn't apply. I am convinced absolutely without a doubt, based on Ezra 9 and Deuteronomy 7, that these marriages of these two men to these Moabite women was sinful. Okay? It was not what God would have had them to do. Do not marry foreign women, for they will turn your heart. If we can draw a bit of an irony, it is David's own son who becomes the greatest example of this in the Old Testament. A man who marries 700 women, and we are told in Scripture that they turn his heart from the Lord because they're foreigners. Now, I don't know how you can marry 700 women. I have a hard enough time with one. I can't imagine 700. I mean, you realize that's two birthdays a day. Every day, two of your wives are having birthdays. I have a hard enough time working with one wife having a birthday once a year. But that's just my problem. Apparently, he had the kind of wisdom that allowed him to... I don't know. But they turned his heart, right? So what's the point? Is the reason why God prohibits the people of Israel from marrying other nations is because he knows that they will turn from the paganism, they will turn to the paganism, sometimes in a very syncretistic sort of way, in their own homes. So God does not desire for these two boys to marry these two girls. Yes, I know that Ruth ultimately becomes the heroine of the story as we get to the end, but here's what we must not forget here. The Lord, in his sovereignty over the affairs of human beings, allows actions that are against his expressed or even implied desires, generally for the purpose of working through them to further his larger purposes and plans. Okay. So in other words, the primary point here is that God says, this isn't the best. I'm going to allow it. I have to rescind what I was about to say. You knew what I was about to say, right? He doesn't strike him dead. Eh, maybe he does. But look, the fact is that God allowed these two men to marry these two women, and then he uses that choice in Ruth to extend his purposes and plans in the world. I mean, there's no greater picture of this than in the cross of Christ. Jesus himself experienced the worst evil on the planet from God allowing men to kill his own son. Would it have been the best choice? Of course not. Would he have wanted Pilate to make such a choice? Of course not. He gave him all kinds of opportunity to change his mind. But he uses the affairs of human beings and he allows actions that are against his expressed desires, even sinful, for his purposes of working through them to further his larger purposes and plans. This is the essence of Romans 8:28. Where God works all things together for the good of those who are called according to his purpose. Now, coming to verse 5 then, the two boys die. Now, I'm inclined to see their deaths as suspicious. Okay, you may not be, but I am. And here's why. Because they die before their mother. They die before their mother. Their mother outlives them, survives them. That would not be typical in agrarian societies where ages, lifespans were not as great as they would be in our day. So the idea of two sons, not just one, but both sons, dying there in Moab after or before their mother, shortly after each marries, and both being left without children, both being childless, seems to suggest to me that there's more going on here than meets the eye. Now, I realize this could be completely natural, nothing specifically divine in it whatsoever. But whether or not this was directly God's hand in some way, the result is the same. Whether or not God orchestrated their deaths for some divine purpose or not, the result is the same. I mean, Perry just read a passage, didn't he, in which God specifically killed two sons of Judah. for their failure to do what is right. Nothing says he couldn't have done exactly the same thing here. So what do we have? Verse 5, both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. She is now left as a widow, and so are her two daughters-in-law, both left as widows. Three women who are now widows. For Naomi, she is a foreigner in a foreign land. She is an Israelite living in Moab. She has no financial support. Now, Ruth and Orpah clearly are emotional and spiritual support to her, but the means of financial support have evaporated, because in such an agrarian society in the second millennium BC, a widow has no visible means of support. She has no prospects for gaining such financial support. Notice verse 12 when she says, I'm too old to have a husband. Even if I should have a husband and bear sons, would you wait for them to grow up? No. She doesn't see any hope of winding up with a husband. And the social structure of the time places her at the bottom of the ladder. She is in a hopeless situation from a financial and social perspective. So in my opinion, the story best unfolds if we see this situation as an oppression. A providential act of God to oppress this woman through her circumstances. Now, I realize they're caused by poor or sinful choices on the part of Elimelech and the part of his two sons. I recognize that. But it's clearly a providential act of God to oppress her, driving her to the only recourse left to her. And what is the only recourse that she has? Go home. Go back to Israel. Go back to Bethlehem and see if there is some way that she could throw herself upon the mercy of her own people. That's her only choice. Otherwise, in this particular place, especially as a foreign woman, she really doesn't have much hope in this situation. Now, when I say a providential act of God, I mean the working of God in the course of normal events to accomplish His plans. Even if God didn't specifically kill off Mahlon and Chilion, even if God didn't specifically act to cause them to stay there or whatnot, it is still obvious that God is working, His hand is orchestrating the events of Naomi's life, forcing her back to Israel with Ruth, which God will, in His sovereignty, use her return and Ruth to accomplish a greater goal. The end of the story is where we're going. The end of the story is that it's back in Israel, under a Redeemer, that a child is born and becomes the grandfather of David. So the story is obviously God's providential hand moving Naomi, forcing Naomi back to Israel. In fact, even in verse 13, she acknowledges this. What did she say? "No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." She herself admits that this is from God. Now, it may be true that she's just blaming God. In her situation, she may not recognize it, but we should. We have the ability to look back upon this 3,000-year-old text and say, it is clear that the hand of God is leading her, pushing her back to Israel. Go back to Israel. I've got a plan. And I'm going to use the circumstances to cause you to go back. Now, I want you to hold that thought for a second. And look now at how Naomi responds to the circumstances. Look at how she responds. Verse 8. She says to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you've dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Naomi insists that Orpah and Ruth remain in Moab, and she gives three reasons why over the course of this text. First, it would be better for them to return to their mother's house than to follow her to Israel. In other words, now that they are widowed, it would be better for them, even if necessary, to move back in with dear old mom and dad than it would be to follow her back to Israel. Her prospects are not that great even going back to Israel. Why would you follow me there? It is probably much more obvious that your mother would be willing to take you in and take care of you than for you to follow me. Okay, so that's her first one. It's purely logical reason. And then secondly, in verse 9, she says, the Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Okay, now she says, here's what she's saying. She says, listen, you're still young. You're still attractive. You haven't had children yet. You're widows. And so there's a good possibility that you could find husbands here in Moab. It's reasonable that you could find a husband here in this place. Your future still holds the possibility of marriage and children in your native land. Now, have you noticed, by the way, in these previous two reasons, that Naomi is willing to acknowledge here that this is the leading of the Lord? Okay, in verse 8, she says, go return to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you. Okay, so I'm going to turn you over to my God to take care of you here in Moab. And she says the same thing in verse 9. The Lord grant that you may find peace in the house of your husband. Okay, that the Lord will lead you in this place. So you'll notice that weaved through all of this text is Naomi recognizing the providence of God and the leading of God through it all. So we'll give her credit for at least recognizing that God can, in fact, work outside of Israel, even. That the God of Israel isn't confined to working just inside Israel. She recognizes the sovereignty of God over all the nations of the world and all the issues of life. And so she puts her daughters-in-law into the hands of Almighty God. But she gives one more reason in verses 11 to 13. She says, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Do you really think I'm going to be able to have children at this point that can become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should find a husband this very night and should bear sons, would you wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying until I have sons and they grow up? It's interesting how the parallel works in this story to the one you just read a moment ago. The reason why Tamar is mad at Judah and tricks him is because Judah doesn't give her the son that hasn't grown up yet, but now is. So Naomi's using exactly the same argument. Look, I'm an elderly widow. There's no possibility of me marrying again and having sons. And even if I did marry and have sons, it would be silly for you two girls to wait for those sons to grow up, become husbands. I mean, it'll take a number of years before they reach marrying age, even if I should find a husband magically tonight and have two sons. That's not going to happen. It'll be years into the future. So what Naomi is saying in this last reason is to follow her thinking that she could still give them husbands was foolish. Stay here. Find yourself a husband in this place. Go back to your mother's house. Go this way. Naomi is convinced that the best course of action for her daughters-in-law is to remain there in Moab. She cannot see, excuse me. She does not foresee any real value in these Moabite girls following her to Israel. But here's what I want you to notice. At this particular moment, as she gives these three reasons, she cannot make the connection between the circumstances she's experiencing right now and the plan of God. She doesn't see it. In fact, she makes no argument to that end at all. In fact, quite the opposite, doesn't she? She says, don't come with me. I'm going back to Israel. I'm probably going back to Israel to die. I have no hope. There's no husband around me. There's no children in me. Just stay here. There's nothing that God can do by you coming with me. She cannot even make the connection that these two girls could follow her back to Israel, to the land where Yahweh lives. See it? She doesn't even see that. She doesn't even see that these three women, the two girls with her, could go back to Israel. And even if they don't find husbands, even if they don't find a family, They find Yahweh. They find the God of Israel. She didn't even make that connection. Now, that's important to the story. I want you to keep that in mind. Now, how do these girls respond? At first, according to verse 10, they both cling to her. They both believe that going with her to Israel is better than staying in Moab. Or at least just staying with her, regardless of where, is the best course of action for their future. So in some sense, they go, we'll go with you. We'll go with you. But as Naomi brings her final reason why you ought to stay, starting in verse 11, right? In the end, Orpah stays in Moab. But Ruth sees a larger agenda, which is another reason why this book is named after her. It's clear that she sees something that even Naomi can't see. She sees something beyond. What we will discover is that Ruth's reasoning is to stay with Naomi's God, not just with Naomi. Now, you'll get that starting in verse 15, which we'll keep to next week's sermon. A point that Naomi herself has not yet come to see. See it? In the first 14 verses of this book, Naomi comes with this assumption as her circumstances go right down into darkness. She can't even see the possibility of something coming from it. It's a Moabite who sees it, not her. In fact, what is ultimately Naomi's response to her circumstances? Well, the answer is found in verse 13. Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. She is bitter. She's looking at her circumstances and she is bitter over what has taken place. Her husband has died. That's bad enough. But then now her two sons have died and she's left in a situation in a foreign land with no hope in the midst of it. And so she has a bitterness both for herself and for them. She has become so self-centered over what the Lord has inflicted upon her that she cannot see what the Lord might be leading her and the girls towards. She's become so self-centered. I mean, I read to you verses 8 to 13, did I not? Who's it all about? Naomi. My problems. My issues, my struggles, the Lord has done this, He's taken my husband from me, and now you really think that I'm going to be able to be, to bear you children, or bear children so that you might have a husband? No, I can't do that. There's nothing for me here. There's probably nothing for me there. You don't need to hang with me. She's become bitter over her circumstances. You see, my friends, it is easy to allow ourselves to become bitter over our circumstances. To look at circumstances and become bitter over them. To get to that point where we become so self-centered that we don't even consider the sovereign hand of Christ over us. That we look at the circumstances of our lives and we respond to them in such a way that we say, the hand of God is against me. God must hate me. God must have cast me aside. I'm no longer a Christian because look at my life. It's obvious God can't love me. Look what He's doing to me. Look at the situation that I'm having to experience. That's easy, isn't it? It's easy. But listen to these words from Hebrews chapter 12. Listen to what the writer says here. He says, my son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by Him. For the Lord disciplines the one He loves and chastises every son whom He receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? Those are words that fall hollow in our culture. If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For our earthly fathers, they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them. But he that is God disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. But later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who've been trained by it. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees. And make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. You see, my friends, the circumstances of your life, all of the trials and tribulations and troubles, the pains, the sufferings, the griefs, the agonies, the depressions, the forlornment, the disappointments, all of what God has purposed into your life is for a purpose. It is for a purpose. This is not purposeless suffering. Naomi's suffering was not purposeless. It had a purpose. It had a value to Almighty God. Its intention is to strengthen us. And it is the Spirit who will use all kinds of circumstances in the life of the true follower of Christ to mold us into holiness, to train us in righteousness. We must never become bitter through our circumstances. There's no room for bitterness in the life of a Christian. The true follower of Christ should be looking through our circumstances, not at them, through them, to see this Christ who has had victory. For he himself said, in this life you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world. We are going to suffer. We are going to be disappointed. We're going to go through grief of every imaginable kind. We're going to experience rejection. We're going to experience fear. We're going to experience darkness. We're going to experience hatred. We're going to experience failure and sin and guilt and shame and so many other things. We're going to experience all of them. But they come down from the throne of Almighty God for the purpose of disciplining us, molding us in holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. It's interesting that the writer in Hebrews in verse 15 speaks of this root of bitterness. It harkens back to a phrase in Deuteronomy 29, 16 to 18. You know how we lived in the land of Egypt, this is Moses writing, and how we came through the midst of the nations through which you passed. Nations like Moab. And you have seen their detestable things, their idols of wood and stone, of silver and gold, which were among them. Beware, lest there be among you a man or woman or clan or tribe whose heart is turning you away today from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of those nations. Beware, lest there be among you a root bearing poisonous and bitter fruit. Is the irony there? What's he saying? Moses is saying the reason why you should not be out in that world marrying those women is because they're going to bring those idols and they're going to grow bitterness towards the true God in you. And my friends, that's the reality of our day as well. As we leave this place and go out into that world and we face all of what this society is throwing at us, we must remember that this society is trying to lead us to ever greater and greater measures of idolatry. Self-centeredness is the key theme of the society in which we live. It's all about you. It's all about you. See, it's all about you expressing your truth. Not the truth, your truth. But my friends, listen to me. All this produces is bitterness. All this produces is hatred of the true God and bitterness over our circumstances rather than hope. Naomi failed to see that the girls coming with her to Israel would bring them into the presence of Yahweh himself and the proper knowledge of worship of him amongst the people of God. She never saw that. We need to see that. We need to see that. As true followers of Christ, we must never allow a root of bitterness to grow in us that's caused by the idolatries around us. And we must remember that the circumstances that God has placed into our lives are designed in His sovereignty to make us more and more like this Christ every day. So rejoice in tribulation. Rejoice in tribulation. Not easy to do, because our natural tendency is to despise it. No, we are to rejoice in it. What is the Lord doing with me this day in this tribulation? What am I learning from it? What will be the goal?